This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of the grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every ear. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Our headlines. Two Iranian intelligence organizations say undeniable evidence shows the United States masterminded the recent riots in the country. Iran says U.S. sanctions prevent imports of food and medicine to the country in violation of a ruling by International Court of Justice. Also, Russia announces the end of mobilization of 300,000 reservists to fight in Ukraine. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, Iran says it is in possession of, quote, irrefutable documents proving that the U.S. was the chief architect of the recent riots in the country. In a statement, Iran's intelligence ministry and the intelligence organization of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps said the U.K., Israeli, and Saudi spy agencies also colluded in the plot. The statement added that the plans were hatched prior to the riots to create a nationwide crisis in Iran. It said the ultimate aim of the plot was to, quote, commit crimes against the Iranian nation, violate Iran's territorial integrity, and pave the ground for further foreign pressure against the country. The two Iranian intelligence organizations also said despite the claims of the current U.S. administration, it's continuing and even intensifying the so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran. The statement said the U.S. is also targeting the social fabric in Iran by trying to polarize the nation. Political commentator Mohammad Ali Araki tells us how the U.S. and its allies foment unrest to overthrow governments that do not toe their line.
The statement that has been issued by the Islamic Republic of Iran officials is a very precise and clear statement. The United States of America and its allies around the world believe in an idea called organic uprisings. Now, it's not as honest as it looks, organic uprisings. What they want to do is they look to overthrow governments that are not in line with their benefits. And the Islamic Republic of Iran and its allies in the Middle East and around the world are an example of those governments. So therefore, what they do is they try to start protests that when you look at it from outside, when you zoom back, it looks like yes, there are people here, they disagree with their government. But in fact, the reality is that the United States of America and all the intelligence services that they are working closely with, they are the ones behind this. And this can clearly be seen in the events that started from Mahsa Amini ongoing to the recent terrorist attacks that occurred in Shiraz. And it is important for me to mention that these will not end here. They will keep on trying, but they will fail in the end, and they will not reach the target that they wish to reach.
Iranians from different walks of life have taken to the streets to condemn the terrorist attack in the southern city of Shiraz, which left 13 people dead and dozens injured. Salman Khojouri reports.
Iranians have held nationwide rallies to condemn the Wednesday terrorist attack in the southern city of Shiraz. The protesters took to the streets in different cities following Friday prayers. They chanted slogans and held banners, calling for the perpetrators and their backers to be brought to justice.
Today we're here to show the world that we are all together. We are a powerful country. We're going to fight against terrorism. We're going to fight against violence. You want us to be separated. You want us to fight against each other, but we are the one. We are powerful.
At least 13 people, including two children, were killed after gunmen opened fire on pilgrims at the Shah Charagh Holy Shrine in Shiraz. 26 others were wounded. The Daesh terror group claimed responsibility shortly after the attack.
We strongly condemn any acts of terrorism and desecration of Muslim sanctities. We want to say that we hate London-based news channels like Iran International, Manoto, and BBC because they are instigating violence and unrest in Iran.
We are here to send this message to Israel, the U.S., and their allies that through creating riots and unrest in the country, they cannot achieve their sinister goal of disintegration of Iran. We are united.
Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has called on security agencies, the judiciary, intellectuals, activists, and the entire nation to act in unison to confront the current which is disregarding and disrespecting people's lives, security, and sanctities. Meanwhile, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has also vowed that the Islamic Republic would deliver a crushing response to those who were behind the bloodshed.
The ralliers have called on Iranian authorities to prosecute the main perpetrators of the heinous crime of terrorist attack in Shiraz and take all necessary measures to maintain security in the country as soon as possible. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Political commentator Fuadi Zadi tells us why meddlesome U.S. policies will once again fail in Iran.
Western intelligence services have infiltrated ISIS and ISIS-linked groups for many, many years. And they utilize these groups to achieve foreign policy goals. You know, the terrorist attack in Shiraz happened on the 40th day of passing of Mahsa Amini. So this is a way of showing support for the riots in Iran. But this is a terrorist organization. So instead of just issuing a statement, they engage in some sort of terrorist activity, killing 15 innocent people at the shrine. So overall, I think when these type of things happen, Iranians realize what's going on. Majority of people in Iran are used to this type of American scheme. They know all about color revolution and the different tactics that Americans use to orchestrate color revolution. And this is going to backfire. And what you see in demonstrations today is basically the backfire that is expected from the Iranian people. And so the Americans are going to fail once again when it comes to their Iran policy.
Iran says U.S. sanctions have prevented its imports of food and medicine. Iran says this is against a ruling by the International Court of Justice mandating that Washington exempts food and medicine from the bans. Iran's Deputy U.N. Ambassador Zahra Ejadi says the U.S. has failed to comply with the court order. She says the U.S. has even imposed additional sanctions on Iran, openly defying the judgment. Ejadi made the statement while speaking during a UNGA debate on the International Court of Justice. The U.S. has launched a campaign of maximum pressure on Iran since former President Donald Trump withdrew from the 2015 nuclear deal. Under the policy, Washington reimposed unilateral sanctions that were removed under the accord. Political commentator Scott Bennett earlier shared his thoughts on the issue. Let's take a listen.
It is a crime against humanity. It's a crime of genocide. It's a weapon of genocide. Of course, this shouldn't surprise us, first of all, from the political leadership of a country that has killed hundreds of thousands of Iraqi children under Madeleine Albright, that has killed children in, of course, the Iraq-Iran war with the chemical weapons that the United States supplied to Iraq. And now we see the United States also killing the children and elderly senior citizen people in Ukraine by empowering the fanatical maniacs of the woke left in the Nazi tattooed uniform of Zelensky's regime to bomb and engage in genocide. So it shouldn't surprise us that there's no moral restraint or sanity or decency in the Western hegemonic obsessionists in the political and military class This should, of course, be brought up to the entire world community and the entire United Nations and the entire World Criminal Court, and it should be demanded that sanctions against the United States are imposed for this crime of genocide, this crime against humanity.
Iran's foreign minister once again dismisses allegations that it has provided drones to Russia to use in the war against Ukraine. Hossein Amir Abdullahian says Tehran's policy regarding the war in Ukraine is refraining from sending weapons to the warring parties. He made the comments in a phone call with his Ukrainian counterpart. The foreign minister also said Tehran respects the territorial integrity of countries and seeks the cessation of the war and the displacement of people. He called for Ukrainian officials to avoid the influence of some extremist European politicians. Amir Abdullahian also expressed Iran's readiness to hold technical meetings with Ukrainian military experts on the issue of drones. For his part, Dmytro Kuleba welcomed Iran's stance and highlighted the importance of technical military talks between the two countries. Russia's defense minister says partial mobilization of 300,000 reservists to fight in Ukraine is now complete. Sergei Shoigu says over a quarter of the draftees have been deployed in the battlefield. He stressed that no additional mobilization is planned for now. This is the first mobilization of reservists by Russia since World War II. The Russian president ordered a call-up in September after he approved annexation of four eastern and southern Ukrainian regions. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has expressed doubt that a call-up is finished. He says Moscow may need to send new soldiers to the conflict very soon. Our correspondent is with us, Johnny Miller from Crimea. Johnny, it's good to talk to you. So tell us more about what's going on right now in the war in Ukraine.
Well, last night I was woken up by a series of loud explosions here in Sevastopol. Local authorities say that that was the Russian Black Sea Fleet, based, of course, here in Crimea, shooting down Ukrainian drones. It's another indication of how much superior Russian air defense systems are than their Ukrainian than the Ukrainians. Ukrainians, of course, asking, pleading with the West or NATO to give them the most advanced weaponry to help them gain parity on the battlefield with Russia. But the United States particularly is wary at times to give Ukraine their most advanced weapons, worried that some of them might fall into Russian hands, that technology. Also perhaps worried that some of this technology may not be as good as they would hope. Would, for example, the most advanced NATO air defense system be able to shoot down the most advanced Russian missiles? So in terms of, also in terms of this mobilization, Russia, of course, says they've completed the mobilization of 300,000 soldiers. They say about 80,000 of those are already in the battle zone. So there's, we'll have to wait and see as to what Russia plans to do with these 300,000 troops, a huge injection of manpower, of course. Will they use them simply to hold the line, or will they try to strike out, perhaps from Belarus in the north? Perhaps they will use them to try to take the rest of the Donbass, or will they strike out another, perhaps Kharkiv or Odessa?
Johnny, why is there a controversy about the end of mobilization of 300,000 reservists to fight in Ukraine's war? Because President Zelensky has expressed doubt that Russia might continue sending more soldiers to fight in the war in Ukraine.
Sorry, what was the first part of your question?
The question is, why is there a controversy about the end of mobilization of 300,000 reservists? President Zelensky has expressed doubt about it. Why is there a doubt?
Well, I'm not sure what kind of doubt that Zelensky is referring to. It's clear that Russia says that around 200,000 of those troops are still being trained in Russia. Around 80,000 have now already arrived in the combat zone. So it's clear that Russia has injected a huge amount of manpower into this conflict. And there is a feeling, though, that Russia may well wait a couple of weeks for the elections, midterm elections in the United States. Many, if Republicans make some gains there, some of them have indicated that they may be less willing to continue to support arming Ukraine. So there's a feeling maybe Russia may well wait until after those elections before utilizing these reserves.
Johnny Miller, thank you so much for joining us, our correspondent in Crimea. Moving on, the United States has officially ended its economic recession, but a double-dip recession is expected to be around the corner. That has the 63% of Americans who live paycheck to paycheck especially concerned as they head to the ballot box next week. Rami Mazohiri reports from Chicago.
New data shows that the United States economy ended its recession last quarter, but there is widespread admission across the mainstream media that the official numbers don't capture the depth of economic difficulties. At 2.6% in the third quarter, it was the first sign of GDP growth in 2022. However, if the vast increase in the sales of arms and gas to Europe are excluded, then the U.S. economy would have shrunk 0.2%, thus remaining in recession. So what's truly keeping the U.S. economy afloat is the lack of a diplomatic solution to the unrest in Ukraine.
It's terrible for the economy. You know, on paper, it shows that a certain factor of the economy is doing well during war because they're the ones making money off of the weapons. But for real people, it's only bad. And we call for an end to all unjust wars.
Many point to non-governmental data for the true state of the economy. A new survey shows that a stunning 63% of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. With inflation at levels unseen in nearly four decades, credit debt at levels unseen in three decades, and unemployment expected to soar this winter, most economists are predicting a return to recession known as a double-dip recession.
It's a bipartisan problem of two parties that don't support anyone but themselves and their own corporate fundraisers. Inflation is said to be the most insidious of all taxes. It confiscates our wealth, a good part of it in a way that no one even realized.
The lack of broad economic stability is the primary reason that the Democratic Party is polling to lose control of Congress in the midterm elections on November 8th. That would create a divided government, which would make implementing economic solutions at the federal level even harder. This looming political stagnation is fueling even more pessimism about the future, which may then create even more Americans who are just one paycheck from disaster. Rami Mazahari, Chicago.
That does it for this edition of World News.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all. From the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
In the limelight.
In a situation where the Biden administration's comprehensive support for Ukraine against Russia continues, the result of the latest opinion polls indicate a decrease in the support of the American public for these aids. The recent opinion polls show that almost half of the American public are against their country's arms assistance to Ukraine. Economic experts say U.S. arms aid to Ukraine continues at a time when most of the American public are facing poverty, high consumer prices, unprecedented inflation, and livelihood problems. Some political analysts also say that by sending huge cargoes of arms and weaponry to Ukraine, in fact, the United States and Britain want to test the effectiveness of their weapons. We have taken a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Russia Today tells us more about this story. The Pentagon issued a list of American military aid approved for Ukraine so far this year, outlining nearly $17 billion in arms sales and military weapons, including tens of thousands of anti-tank systems, just shy of 1 million artillery rounds, and an array of heavy and long-range weapons platforms. A fact sheet on U.S. security assistance to Ukraine, released by the Pentagon, recently notes that Washington has authorized $16.9 billion worth in military aid for Kiev in 2022, the vast majority of which came after Moscow started its special operation in the neighboring country in February. The list includes more than 1,400 Stinger anti-aircraft systems, over 8,500 Javelin anti-tank weapons, and 32,000 other anti-armor platforms, as well as some 988,000 howitzer rounds, 60 million rounds of small arms ammunition, and tens of thousands of mortars, rockets, and grenades. The Pentagon has also sent large quantities of heavy weaponry, among them over 150 artillery pieces, 20 Mi-17 helicopters, 200 M113 armored personnel carriers, hundreds of Humvees, and 16 high-mobility artillery rocket systems, or HIMARS, one of the longest-range platforms provided by Washington to date. In addition to non-lethal gear such as helmets, body armor, and mine-clearing equipment, the U.S. supplied Ukraine with at least 700 Switchblade suicide drones and an undisclosed number of Claymore anti-personnel mines. In its latest $1.1 billion aid package for Kiev, announced on Wednesday, 28th of September, the U.S. Defense Department vowed to more than double the number of HIMARS units operated by the Ukrainian military, seeking to send another 18 on top of the 16 already authorized. However, officials noted it could take a few years before the rocket systems are ready for the battlefield, as they will not be pulled from existing U.S. stocks, but rather contracted to American arms manufacturers. A senior Pentagon official told reporters the HIMARS are intended to serve as a core component of Ukraine's fighting force in the future, explaining that it is a sizable investment designed to prepare Kiev for the long haul. The apparent shift to a longer-term approach comes as some military experts warned that Washington will not be able to keep up the pace of security assistance set over the last 6 months, with CNBC noting mounting problems in the American weapons supply chain in a recent report. Russia's RIA Novosti news agency explains more about the same story. A new opinion poll conducted by the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft revealed nearly half of the American public are against sending military aid to Ukraine if the U.S. is not involved in diplomatic efforts to resolve the conflict. The opinion poll showed on Tuesday, 27th of September, almost half of the respondents, or 47%, said they only support the continuation of U.S. military aid to Ukraine if Washington is involved in ongoing diplomacy. About 40% of those who took part in the opinion poll expressed their support for providing weapons to Kiev, regardless of the negotiation process. Roughly 58% said they would oppose the U.S. providing military aid to Ukraine at current levels if their own country suffers higher gas prices and a higher cost of goods. The opinion poll also revealed that 57% of likely voters support the U.S. pursuing diplomatic negotiations as soon as possible to end the conflict, while only 32% oppose such efforts. Executive Vice President at the Quincy Institute, Trita Parsi, was quoted as saying in the release, "Americans recognize what many in Washington don't. Russia's special operation in Ukraine is more likely to end at the negotiating table than on the battlefield, and there is a brewing skepticism of Washington's approach to this war, which has been heavy on tough talk and military aid, but light on diplomatic strategy and on engagement." 6% of those surveyed further recognized that Russia's special military operation is among the top issues the U.S. is currently facing. Other concerns included inflation, gun violence in the United States, and the state of the U.S. economy. TASS news agency covers the same story but from a different angle. Head of the Russian delegation at the Vienna talks on military security and arms control, Konstantin Gavrilov, says the United States views the world as a range to test its weapons. Gavrilov made the statement in a speech at the plenary session of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe Forum for Security Cooperation. He was quoted as saying in a speech published by the Russian Foreign Ministry, he said, "It has long been clear that Kiev's handlers in Washington view the whole world as a large testing ground and use any armed conflict, even if they are not directly involved in it, to test the effectiveness of their weapons. Konstantin Gavrilov said, according to a report by the Congressional Research Service on U.S. wars and military interventions around the world since 1798, Washington has unleashed 469 wars and military interventions around the world. The Russian diplomat continued by saying, U.S. Professor J.S. Miller-Lucas concluded the U.S. wars since the Second World War have claimed an estimated 25 million lives with impunity. But Washington has no intention to stop. The diplomat noted U.S.-made weapons continue to be tested on civilians with the help of Ukrainian troops and radicals. He underlined, the Ukrainian Defense Ministry has openly invited companies of the United States military-industrial complex to test pilot projects before mass production, which will allegedly increase the competitiveness of these weapons if they are tested in a combat zone. Well, that's not new, of course. The international community remembers well how, in August of 1945, the United States tested nuclear weapons on civilians in the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Today, we are talking about the actual legalization at the government level of the use of Ukrainian troops and civilians, who will be the targets of these weapons as cannon fodder. Konstantin Gavrilov said Moscow is warning Washington and London against reckless moves that could push the situation around Ukraine to a dangerous point.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Syria.
Part 2.
In Syria, I couldn't look the way I wanted to at the passing of 9 years, as I passed the streets, alleyways, and buildings. I could only keep myself composed to some extent, as opposed to many others who were in shock and awe when they encountered these scenes. Especially when I saw all of those factories and workshops that used to be full of workers, engineers, and technicians 9 years ago. People who are no longer in their workplaces. Many people who are no longer with us. There's not enough space in the ground to hide their bodies. Sometimes a park in the street becomes their burial place. I felt that in Syria, I didn't have the right to speak of anything other than the war for the past 9 years. However, I decided to at least look for answers to why all of this happened in Syria. Why Syria? In In the United States, people are not very political. Therefore, it really doesn't matter to them what happens in the rest of the world.
CBS News came to this place called Attaf with General Frank McKenzie, commander of U.S. forces in the Middle East.
David, we're standing on the Damascus-Baghdad highway, just inside Syria, and what we're doing here is supporting our partners in the fight against ISIS.
However, not all the people here are American. Some members of Syria's opposition visit the TANF base regularly. Apart from their looks and uniforms, they can be recognized by their Arabic language and their Toyota vans. It appears they are opposed to the Syrian government and have come together to fight the Syrian army. But it appears that their main mission after protecting the American base is controlling the roads that pass through TANF. Of course, the Chinese, in cooperation with many other Asian countries, like Iran, intend to revive the Silk Road. This is a decision which is not secret, as they have talked about it openly on many occasions. Till then, the road linking Baghdad to Damascus, and from there to the Mediterranean coast, is still considered as the Silk Road. Wesley Clark is not the only person who believes the war in Syria was planned long before it started. Many others, like Robert F. Kennedy Jr., also share this belief. He is the nephew of the former President of the United States. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who is both a lawyer and author, published an article in 2016 in Politico magazine entitled "Why Arabs Don't Want Us in Syria." The article stunned many. He writes, "In their view, our war against Bashar Assad did not begin with the peaceful civil protests of the Arab Spring in 2011. In their view, our war against Bashar Assad did not begin with the peaceful civil protests of the Arab Spring in 2011. Instead, it began in 2000, when Qatar proposed to construct a $10 billion, 1,500-kilometer pipeline through Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Syria, and Turkey. To see whether Kennedy's claims are true or false, we go back to the year 2000. As you are aware, Russia is the biggest producer and exporter of natural gas, with Europe being its biggest customer. The Russians export 70% of their produced natural gas to Europe. The US is highly motivated as it tries to find an alternative to Russia's gas. As a result, they have turned to Qatar and Azerbaijan for gas. But the fact is that Europe's demand for gas could not be met via sea only, and that such a huge supply could only be sent to the continent through a pipeline. This was where the notion of the Qatari gas pipeline was put forth. That's the same energy transit route that would pass through Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Syria, and then reach Europe via Turkish terminals. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. writes, "In Putin's view, the Qatar pipeline is a NATO plot to change the status quo, deprive Russia of its only foothold in the Middle East, strangle the Russian economy, and end Russian leverage in the European energy market." This plan faced a big obstacle, the Syrian government. Elsewhere in his article, Kennedy writes, "In 2009, Syrians announced that they would refuse to sign the agreement to allow the pipeline to run through Syria to protect the interests of their Russian allies. They also announced commissioning of Russian-approved Islamic pipeline with cooperation from Iran and Iraq. This Islamic pipeline would transport Iran's gas to the Mediterranean through Iraq and Syria, with its final destination being West and Southwestern Europe. The project would become a huge source of revenue for Syria and Iraq, as well as Iran."
As a result, all the three countries insisted on its execution. Now, there were problems. On the one hand, Qatar's gas could not be transferred via Syria. On the other hand, Iran would gain a foothold in the European energy market. That's why they decided to remove the problem, namely the Syrian government.
This morning, President Obama called on Assad to step aside and announced the strongest set of sanctions to date targeting the Syrian government. These sanctions include the energy sector to increase pressure on the regime. The transition to democracy in Syria has begun, and it's time for Assad to get out of the way. As President Obama said this morning, no outside power can or should impose on this transition.
Cables released by the whistleblower organization WikiLeaks show that the Israeli, Saudi, and U.S. intelligence agencies started to give financial and intelligence assistance to the groups seeking to topple the Syrian government. This dates back to 2 years before the onset of protests in Syria. Regardless of the WikiLeaks cables, the most optimistic interpretation is that the 2011 protests over economic and political problems in Syria provided an opportunity to implement the Qatar gas pipeline to the Mediterranean by toppling the Assad government. Thus, the protests in Syria soon turned into a full-blown armed conflict, unlike Bahrain and Tunisia, where demonstrations remained peaceful. In a 2016 interview with an Italian news outlet, Bashar Assad explained the issue of the pipeline and the unfolding of the crisis in this way.
Many political analysts think the Syrian no to the pipeline routes proposed by Qatar may be one of the reasons why the war had begun in 2011. How important has been your no to Qatar in the beginning of the war?
It is one of the important factors, but it wasn't offered to us publicly. But I think it was planned. There was two routes crossing Syria. One of them is north-south, which is related to Qatar, as you just mentioned. And the other one was east-west to the Mediterranean that crossed Iraq from Iran. And I don't think many countries who opposed the policy of Syria didn't want Syria to be a hub of power, of energy, whether electricity or oil, or even crossroads of railways and so on.
Later, in an interview with Russia Today, the WikiLeaks founder showed a cable that revealed Saudi Arabia and Qatar were providing military assistance to anti-government armed groups and even ISIS in Syria.
Early 2014 email from Hillary Clinton, so not so long after she left Secretary of State, to her campaign manager, John Podesta. That email, it states that ISIS is funded by Saudi Arabia and Qatar, the governments of Saudi Arabia and Qatar. Now, I think this is the most significant email in the whole collection, and perhaps because Saudi and Qatari money is spread all over the place, including into many media institutions. Under Hillary Clinton, and our Clinton emails reveal significant discussion about it, the largest ever arms deal in the world was made with Saudi Arabia, more than $80 billion.
And of course, the consequence of that is that this notorious terrorist group called ISIL or ISIS is created largely with money from the very people who are giving money to the Clinton Foundation.
It's a belief, but thanks to Trump, we can believe much of these stuff. Do you remember when Donald Trump described ISIS as a creation of Obama and Clinton during his 2016 presidential campaign?
He is the founder of ISIS. He's the founder of ISIS. Okay? He's the founder. He founded ISIS. And I would say the co-founder would be Crooked Hillary Clinton. Co-founder, Crooked Hillary Clinton.
Another person who can easily answer these questions is Qatar's former Prime Minister, Hamad bin Jassim.
There's even questions that have been raised about how much funding Qatar has done to some of the Islamic groups in Syria.
Look, in Syria, everybody did mistakes, including your country. When the war or the revolution happened in Syria, all of us worked through two operation rooms, one in Jordan and one in Turkey. The first one was in Jordan, and there was countries, some of the GCC countries, among them the Saudis, the Emiratis, Qatar, United States, and other allies. And they was working from there. And all of us, we was supporting the same group. In Turkey, we did the same. We discover by the time, you supported the wrong group sometimes, sure, but you stop. It doesn't mean that we did not do something wrong there.
Whichever way you look at this story, the support of Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey of armed opposition forces in Syria is unequivocal. We should remember that in the U.S. gas project, the Turks and the Saudis would also receive hefty transit duties for allowing the pipeline pass through their territories. The Qataris themselves have admitted this. When relations between Qatar and Saudi Arabia soured, and the Saudis put Qatar under economic and political pressure, Qatari officials tried to place the blame for what happened in Syria on Riyadh. They were not aware that they were admitting to their role in the Syria crisis too.
And at the beginning, and I say this publicly, the beginning, we have the green light from King Abdullah, late King Abdullah, that we lead and they will support us in this. And that was a discussion direct with Abdullah. And then they try to, later they want to change their opinion. They should inform us. We don't mind to be in the back seat and they
take the lead. They wanted to take the lead?
Yeah, we don't mind they take the lead. They are the biggest, big country. We choose to be there because they don't want to appear in the beginning that they are, you know, completely involved. It was easy to change the regime first year.
Easy.
Easy, because there was no Russian completely involvement, no Iranian.
There were accusations that Qatar funded al-Nusra, which was linked to al-Qaeda. This happened, yes.
I don't think we have a relation with somebody which United States and all the other allies does not know about it.
In the midst of all this, leaders of some terrorist groups would make statements that would serve as a clue for smart people. Like this one. One of the most prominent propaganda leaders of Jabhat al-Nusra, who was critical of Saudi Arabia for sanctioning Qatar, believes the Qataris were among the biggest supporters of the Syrian opposition from the beginning. The city of the Silk Road and Qatar's pipeline project are not the only reasons for the war on Syria. Just look for US military bases in Syria other than Tanf. From the onset of the war in Syria, All U.S. military bases other than Tanf were established in the country's north and northeast. At the time, the U.S. set up the bases under the pretext of helping Syrian Kurds in the face of attacks by terrorist groups, especially ISIS. The Kurds were content with the U.S. military bases and rejected help from the Syrian army. But in 2019, Trump suddenly announced he was withdrawing U.S. forces from Syria. However, it was later revealed that the United States was not only planning to pull out their troops, but intended to beef up their military presence in places like Tanf.
But we are leaving soldiers to secure the oil. Now, we may have to fight for the oil. That's okay. Maybe somebody else wants the oil, in which case they have a hell of a fight. But there's massive amounts of oil, and we're securing it for a couple of reasons. Number one, it stops ISIS, because ISIS got tremendous wealth from that oil. We have taken it. It's secured. Number two, and again, somebody else may claim it, but either we'll negotiate a deal with whoever's claiming it, if we think it's fair, or we will militarily stop them very quickly. We have tremendous power in that part of the world. We have, the airport is right nearby. A very big, very monstrous, very powerful airport and very expensive airport that was built years ago. We're in that Middle East now for $8 trillion. So we don't want to be...
Let's take a look at this map. Nearly all U.S. military bases are close to Syria's oil-rich areas. Trump justifies the U.S. encircling and extortion of these oil wells by claiming that the United States spent $8 trillion. During his presidency, Trump has frequently vowed to pull out U.S. forces from the Middle East, most particularly Syria. But in the same period, the U.S. has built six new bases in northeast Syria.
And one of the things that was brought out by the media, actually, and wisely and correctly brought out, we have very few boats going there anymore because we have our own oil and gas. We don't need it from the Middle East anymore. And that's why we're pursuing a future not only of energy independence, but not just words. You know, you've been hearing energy independence for years and years, and you'd hear it. We have real independence. But what we want now is not independence. We want American energy dominance. Dominance.
All this constitutes only part of the economic motive for Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and the United States to wage a war on Syria. Now the key question is, in light of all the proof, should we keep on thinking that the war in Syria is nothing but an ethno-religious conflict?
In the limelight.
Unexploded Israeli regime ordnance is scattered throughout the Gaza Strip, with at least 1,200 unexploded bombs reportedly found in 2021 in Gaza. These bombs have disabled a part of the population of Gaza and has deteriorated their living condition in the blockaded Gaza Strip. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, Kefah al-Zibda family has a 200-square-meter plot of agricultural land near Absan al-Kibra, a town in Gaza. In 2006, while tending to a crop of vegetables, which he sells at a local market, al-Zibda spotted a round metal object covered in something like copper, sitting atop the soil. As soon as he touched it, it exploded. His cousin heard the explosion and called an ambulance. Unexploded Zionist regime ordnance is scattered throughout the Gaza Strip, with at least 1,200 unexploded bombs reportedly found in 2021 in Gaza. Al-Zibda was 18 at the time of his injury. He is now 34 and partially paralyzed. And while he was lucky to survive the explosion, he has spent the past 16 years negotiating life as a person with a disability in the Gaza Strip. He has found that the already extant difficulties of life in Gaza are compounded for himself and others who have a disability. Al-Zibda has both struggled to access resources that would make his life easier and to receive medical treatment that would improve his condition. Between 2008 and 2021, he applied 13 times for a travel permit to the West Bank, and the Zionist regime has rejected every single one of those requests. In 2008, 2 years after his injury, doctors in Gaza told Al-Zibda that his knees were calcifying and that the arteries to his legs were obstructed. He prepared to travel to Nablus for knee surgery, but the Zionist regime refused his permit to travel. He said, "Finally, I had no other choice but to go to Egypt, where I had surgery on my knees, but unfortunately it failed." In 2016, he traveled again to Egypt for another knee surgery, but it also failed, producing no improvement in his condition. Mahmoud Abu Kamal, deputy manager of the Palestinian General Union of People with Disability, agrees that life for people with a disability in Gaza is trying, whether it's traveling outside of Gaza to receive medical treatment or accessing resources like an air mattress. He added, "Some people with disabilities don't feel they belong to society due to marginalization and challenges they face." After Al-Zibda's initial injury in 2006, doctors advise him to use an air mattress to avoid bed sores, yet even this has proved difficult. He said, "Although the air mattress helps me, the electricity outage for 8 to 16 hours daily exacerbates my suffering, as I have had bed sores for over a decade. It takes my air mattress 30 minutes to charge and the same period to collapse after the electricity is cut. He has no alternate source of power for when the electricity goes out in Gaza. So he is also unable to charge the battery of his scooter, which requires 10 hours of charging to go 20 miles. When the electricity is cut off, I can't get out of the house if the scooter is not charged," he said. "Even when his scooter is charged, the unpaved streets make mobility difficult." Abu Kamal noted that accessibility is an ongoing issue in the Gaza Strip. Abu Kamal said, "We discussed the adaptation of public buildings millions of times with officials, who always reply that these buildings are old and we can't afford to build new ones. If we get financial aid, we will build new accessible buildings. I had to crawl the stairs all the way up." Yusuf Abu Odeh, 37, has struggled with accessibility issues in Gaza's buildings and on its streets for years. Abu Odeh, along with three of his sisters, has cerebral palsy and requires a scooter to leave his home. In 2021, when his scooter broke, he tried to have it fixed but was told that the replacement parts would be even more expensive than just purchasing a new scooter. He requested a new scooter from Gaza's Social Development Ministry, but his request has not been fulfilled. Since the cost of a new scooter can run from 2,000